Hello, I'm Barry Daniel, and this is the podcast of the Middle Way Society. Our aim is to encourage a universal approach to living a more integrated, ethical life, avoiding dogma or any appeal to authority. My guest today is Susan Averbach. Susan has a master's degree in Jewish studies from Graz College and was ordained as a rabbi by the International Institute for Secular Humanistic Judaism last year. One of her goals as a rabbi is to work towards integrating Buddhist practice with humanistic Judaism and to promote a more middle way perspective within this tradition. Hello, Susan. Welcome to the Middle Way Society podcast.
Well, thank you. Thank you for having me.
Okay, well, could we begin, Susan, by you telling us a bit about your background?
Sure. I grew up in Chicago, and my mother was Orthodox. I'm from a mixed marriage. My mother was Orthodox Jewish, and my father was Workman Circle Jewish, secular. And I, as the daughter, went the way my mother went and became Orthodox and kept kosher, followed all of the laws. Shabbat, always walk, never took a ride, all of the particular laws.
Yeah.
And my brothers went the way of my father, which was more secular.
Mm-hmm.
And it's very interesting because I was reading about the middle way and about how people tend to do what their parents do, and then they come of age and maybe think about it some more and may go another way. But I became disillusioned when I was a teenager. I started to read about the Holocaust and thought what sort of all-powerful God would allow something like that to happen.
Mm-hmm.
I started to look at the people around me, the rabbi of my congregation. I'm from the south side of Chicago. And in the U.S., sometimes in neighborhoods will change ethnically.
Yeah.
And white people will leave a neighborhood completely. And our rabbi, who had been who had marched in the civil rights movement, was the first person to move when African-American people started moving into our neighborhood. And I became very disillusioned because when you're a teenager, everything's in black and white. And if the rabbi can do that, forget about Judaism. And there were other things as well that happened that made me disillusioned. And I truly left. And it was right before I went to college. And then when I went to college in 1967, I was so excited by the world, this big world out there that was bigger than my parochial Orthodox Jewish world.
Yeah.
And I found it very exciting. It also coincided with the anti-Vietnam War movement that I became very active in. So I went from being Orthodox. I mean, we all have a religion. This is what Ella says, and it's totally true. I went from Orthodox Jewish to the New Left.
Right.
And I was very active in the anti-war movement and went to 6 meetings a day while going to college, and really felt an urgency about ending the war in Vietnam. As time went on, I ended up in Berkeley, where I went to college, and I became disillusioned with the left in a very similar way that I had with Orthodoxy. There were people who were, I thought of Students for a Democratic Society as being democratic. And when things began to be not democratic and people started to become violent, I couldn't be part of that.
Yeah.
And I discovered the women's movement. Which was just beginning, the modern women's movement.
Yeah.
And with some other people, started the first women's underground newspaper, It Ain't Me, Babe, we named it.
Fantastic.
And became active in that. And we had a radio program in San Francisco as a reaction to a DJ named Tony Pig, he called himself, in opposition to the women's movement. So we went and sat in at the radio station and said, we want equal time with Tony Pig. And we got it.
Brilliant.
So we produced this wonderful radio program this is in 1970, probably 1970. And this person helped us, this guy Scoop Nisker, who was a Buddhist, by the way, but that's just neither here nor there. And I became, what ended up happening is our group, one of the people in our group was upset by the program manager being chauvinist. I mean, this was a huge metro media station, and instead of being happy to have this opportunity, there's one of our members who says, you're a chauvinist, you know, and he said, well, you can't come here anymore. And the group voted to not use their facility anymore because he had said that.
Wow.
I became more and more disillusioned with the political scene. I really didn't have the skills to deal with the conflict. And I decided to become an artist, mm-hmm. which I had a strong propensity to do. And I thought, well, I'll change the world through art.
Not a bad plan.
I did for 20 years. I had control over that.
Yeah.
And I didn't have to deal with the conflicts that you have in these political organizations. It could be more pure. In a way, I think the orthodoxy is always fueling this to be more pure. Mm-hmm. But it is, and I got married, I had children, and I became more and more, I loved the art that I was doing, but it was not satisfying to me because it had no social dimension. And I ended up rethinking that. And then in 1987, I went to a wedding in Michigan, and it was a wedding of my cousin, and it was intermarriage. My cousin's Jewish and his wife is Christian. And the rabbi who officiated, Rabbi Sherwin Wein, did a wonderful job. I loved the ceremony, and every word that was said was something I could relate to. There were no traditional prayers, but it was very moving. It wasn't like a judge, you know, it wasn't dry. And afterwards, my mother said, that rabbi's an atheist. And I thought, how amazing. I never heard of such a thing. So I got his book, Judaism Without God. And I read it and I thought, oh my goodness, this is exactly how I view the world. And I was very excited. And I thought, well, when my kids are older, maybe I'll start a group, because he talked about groups. It was called the Society for Humanistic Judaism. And it started very small in 1968. And it started in one congregation. And I thought, well, I'll start a group like this. And then I noticed a little ad in the Jewish newspaper, one Yom Kippur, which is a holiday that I had not celebrated since I was a child, that said, join the humanists for Yom Kippur. And I thought, that's funny. There's a group here in the Bay Area. And I signed up and we went, and there was a beautiful Yom Kippur service. Instead of the words of there's a melody that is very beautiful that's in a traditional service, the Kol Nidre melody, but without the words. The words that I would object to. A woman from the symphony had a cello, and she played Kol Nidre on the cello, and it was a beautiful service. And in this group, they would ask people at the end of the service, would you like to say a few words about your experience uh-huh. of the service? And I got up and I said, this is so wonderful to be able to have Yom Kippur for the first time since I was a child, mm-hmm. and feel that I could have integrity, not say words I didn't believe. I was just so thrilled to be there.
So you could embrace it.
Yes, and within a very short time, they said, well, will you be our leader? We'll send you for training. And they did. They sent me to Detroit area, where the institute was, for training to become a madricha, which is a leader. And the madrichim are people who can officiate at weddings and do funerals, lead communities, and it's only a 2 or 3 year program.
Okay.
And after I led this community for about 5 years, I decided that I wanted, Sherwin Wine called me up at work one day and he said, Susan, if we had our rabbinic program in the summers so that you could come for a few weeks every summer, would you enroll? And I said, sure. And I did, because the rabbinic program before that required that you live in Detroit.
Okay.
And meet with them every week and get a PhD in Judaic studies. And they changed the requirements to require that you come to the seminars.
Yep.
And I thought, well, I'll do it at my own pace. I'm working full time. And that's what I did. And I thought it would take 5 years. But then I got hit by a car in 2002, and that slowed everything down because I had to recover and learn to walk again. And I learned a lot from that experience, but it definitely slowed down the process. And I decided I was doing too many things, which is, in a way, I thought might be why I got hit by a car. Maybe I wasn't paying attention as I was crossing the street. I had two funerals coming up, or two memorials that weekend. I had a wedding planned that I was officiating at, working full time and studying. It was too much.
Mm-hmm.
So it took 14 years, and I got ordained in November.
How did that feel?
That was so long.
Okay, and staying with the theme of humanistic Judaism, but bringing in the middle way, what does the middle way mean to you? And then why do you think humanistic Judaism offers a middle way?
Well, the middle way to me, one of the speeches I was going to give when I was ordained, I wrote three speeches, but the first one I wrote was going to be about the middle way. And I was seeking in Judaism a middle way between the exclusivity of Judaism, which is very parochial, the idea of chosenness,
mm-hmm.
the idea that you should stay within your tribe and not go too far out, I really objected to. And the inclusiveness of humanistic Judaism, I mean, our communities are completely open and everybody is welcome. And we officiate at weddings on the condition that the people love each other and want to get married, not that they're Jewish or somebody's going to convert. There's never any kind of, everyone is respected.
So from a humanistic Judaism perspective, what does it mean to be a Jew?
To be a Jew is to identify with the culture and the history of the Jewish people.
Yeah.
And it means different things to different people. Even within the humanistic Jewish world, it's very individual. But to be a Jew is to identify with the culture and history of the Jewish people.
Right. So it's not about blood then? Or
it's not about belief.
Or blood.
Not about blood either, no. It's not. It's about identification and with the culture and the history. So if people want to identify with that, great. If they want to just come to events or study texts together, even if they don't identify with it, they're welcome. But as far as what Judaism is, it's an identification with the culture and history of the Jewish people and caring about what happens to the Jewish people, and recognizing that Judaism has evolved. It has a history. It was never one thing.
Yeah.
And when people say the tradition, that's a misnomer, because there is no the tradition. It just does not exist.
Is it something you could pin down with a concept or a word, or is it just too woolly?
Too woolly. It's very, I mean, we have a very history orientation, so we like to look at the history of what we're called Jews. So, for example, one of the most interesting courses I ever took was taught by Gabriella Boccaccini, who is a scholar of the Second Temple period. And he teaches about the origin of Christianity and the origin of Judaism. And what I learned in that class is that Rabbinic Judaism, which is the Judaism that most people know about, came after Christianity. Now, how many people know that? They think Christianity came out of what they think of as Rabbinic Judaism. But no, there was a temple cult, and people brought animals to this temple to sacrifice. And out of that developed a number of Judaisms, some that still exist, some that do not exist anymore. And one of them was Christianity.
Right. I didn't know that either.
It eventually split off, but it took a very long time. And even if you look in Talmud, you will see traces of the arguments. And there are even famous rabbis or sages that you read about in Talmud who may have been followers of Jesus. It's hard to know, but you can read between the lines. So I find that fascinating,
especially
for interfaith dialogue. But we look at the real history. We don't have an agenda to promote the theology. And because of that, we can look at the real history with completely freely.
Yeah.
Not worry about what someone might think about, well, that doesn't really fit with how we're going to celebrate Passover. For example, one of the first things I learned as a student to become a Madricha is that the Exodus probably never happened. Now, that was just amazing to me. I mean, I've always assumed, of course it happened, but it didn't happen. There's no evidence that it happened. Maybe someday they might find a little evidence of a few people leaving Egypt. I think it's unlikely. It's a story. And stories are really important. I mean, that's why I like those dimensions of the religion that you talked about during one of your podcasts. The mythic is really important. So something like Passover, whether the Exodus happened or not, it can be a very meaningful holiday, and you create the meaning with how you practice it. It's not that you have to say, you have to believe we really were slaves in Egypt. No. I mean, it's the central story of Judaism. And if you look in a traditional prayer book, in any conservative or reform or Orthodox synagogue, you will find reference to the Exodus. It is an extremely important story. But it can be reframed, it can be reinterpreted, and it can be very meaningful as in a middle way as humanists. So you can be agnostic, and you can be atheist, and you can be theistic if you want, whatever, but you can find meaning in this story without it being an actual occurrence.
Yeah, that's great, isn't it? It's very, as you say, it's very freeing, that having that sort of perspective.
Integrative.
Exactly,
know.
Yeah. Again, from looking at this from that perspective, and thinking about the sort of dualisms of religion and secularity, where do you see yourself there? Would you describe yourself as religious or secular or what?
Well, I can't speak for all of humanistic Judaism. I can speak for myself. I consider, and we disagree about this. So when people were even naming the institute, it became named the International Institute for Secular Humanistic Judaism. I consider myself religious. I am agnostic, but I am religious. And
what does that mean, Susan, to you?
It means that well, for me personally, my religion is that we're all connected with each other, and we need to work together to find meaning in our existence and in our practice. And when we do that, it needs to touch us in a very deep way that's integrative. So that, and I agree that integrative and spiritual are the same thing. So, I mean, it's hard to describe, but if I have a group, for example, that's been meeting for a number of years in my home. It's an interfaith. We call it a Shabbat meditation group, even though it's Saturday evening. And there are people there. There's a person who was a nun for 10 years, and is no longer a nun, but goes to Jewish Renewal Synagogue with her partner. A person who was born again Christian and then converted to Catholicism a few years ago. Secular Jews, Zen Buddhists, a number of people, different backgrounds. But we sit together and we meditate. And we study texts together sometimes, or we share our own spiritual journey sometimes, and then we share dinner. And that's a very spiritual group.
Mm-hmm.
It's a small group, and it's our version of church or a synagogue.
How does metaphysics or dogma or doctrine fit into this picture?
It does not. It doesn't fit in. I mean, in humanistic Judaism, we tend to be more science oriented.
Yeah.
We're comfortable knowing that we don't know.
Yeah.
And we're open to whatever shows itself. But as far as individual experience of I saw God or I saw, you know, a purple people eater, whatever, that's off. I mean, there, in a way, there is dogma in the Society for Humanistic Judaism, which is that we are committed to a humanist point of view, and people have the power to change things as much as they can, and praying to a higher power is not really our orientation. So we do have beliefs, which is that people, we believe that people need to take control of the world as far as they can, and change things. So if there's a terrible social problem, we don't give it up to God to fix it, we fix it.
Let's just go back to these dimensions of religion you spoke about earlier. These were originally put forward by the philosopher Ninian Smart, and I'm quoting here from Robert Ellis's book, Truth on the Edge. These are the mythic, social, experiential, moral, doctrinal and ritual dimensions of religion. And it is to be noted then here that only the fifth dimension, the doctrinal, is specifically about belief. And even then there remains the question of whether religious beliefs are necessary metaphysical. So that leaves us with the mythic dimension, significant stories, the social dimension, the experiential dimension, for example, prayer and meditation, the moral dimension and the ritual, all of which can be counted in Smart's account as religious, but which are not necessarily metaphysical. And then Robert goes on to say that there is nevertheless a widespread habit in Western society to identify religion with supernatural and therefore metaphysical belief. Now, this is exemplified by the widespread habit of referring to religions as faiths. Now, Robert argues that, on the contrary, that religion is simply an aspect of human experience, which may be seen in metaphysical terms or not. To claim to not be religious, for example, is about as meaningful as claiming not to be historical or not to be geographical. Just as we all have a location and we all have a history, we all have significant stories, social groupings, experiences, moral practices, beliefs and rituals, many of which cohere together as sources or expressions of our values. Now, you really resonated with these features of religion. How or in what way does this relate to your understanding of a Jewish middle way, Susan?
Yes, other than the doctrinal, which doesn't work for us in the humanistic Jewish movement, I think that in the Judaism that we create, which is always being created, we can look at our stories, we can look at Tanakh, we can look at Talmud, we can look at our literature and in new ways and study together and find stories that resonate for us as modern people. All interpretations are open. We can read together and find integration through stories. We can gather together. That's the social aspects. So it's mythic, social, experiential, moral, ritual. So social, we get together, for example, on Passover or Shabbat. We can get together and create a Passover that has meaning using the story and the morals of the story and the experience of being together. And when, for example, in our Passover Seder, we don't say a special prayer for washing our hands. We pour water over each other's hands and we think of something we want to let go of. And we all say, let it go. That's meaningful for us in our own lives. And the people who gather around the table, some are Jewish, some are not, it doesn't matter. We're all together celebrating this. So it's social, mythic, experiential. That's an experience. And Shabbat especially. Shabbat is this special day. It's the first day off in history, I believe, that came from Jewish practice, taking the day off. And we can do it in our own way. Have a day of meditation or whatever it means to you to have a being day rather than a doing day. And rituals, you can light candles. You don't have to say traditional prayers to light the candles. You can light the candles as a way to mark this special time outside of time, this very nice moment of not doing and be able to relax and create the Shabbat that you want to create. So there are five of these six dimensions that we can do in the middle way that does not require any metaphysical belief or doctrine or God, but that is meaningful for us and enriches us and integrates us beyond some sort of scientific, you know, we are just people eating and working and whatever. It enriches our lives tremendously to look at these stories, to have these rituals, and to celebrate together and be with each other. Same for weddings, for example. You say seven blessings in a traditional Jewish wedding, and they're all about God. We don't do that. We may say seven blessings, but they're humanist blessings that we write and we ask people to help us write them. And if it's a wedding between someone who's Irish and someone who's Jewish, we might take Irish blessings and include them in seven blessings. So we have the seven which is traditional seven, and we include the culture of everybody. So it's constantly creating. We have to constantly be creating these things, and it is more work and effort. You don't just pull out a book and say, okay, this is what you say when this happens, but it's more meaningful because we're saying what we believe, and we can keep our integrity in doing that. And yet we can be social as well. There are people who go to synagogue because they want to see their friends, but they have to say words they don't believe. So we're offering an opportunity for people to only say words that they do believe, and to also be with their friends and have it be very open and meet everyone's needs. And we all work on it together. So if everyone creates it together, and that is the middle way, every individual has responsibility for figuring things out. There's no one truth. It's constantly, you know, it's all our different perspectives, and we have to try to come to some idea about whatever we're trying to come to some idea about, but we do it together using our intelligence and using our listening skills as well. We have to be able to hear each other. And I noticed in Ellis's book, he talked about Marshall Rosenberg, the Center for Nonviolent Communication, where he talked about nonviolent communication. That's so important in practicing the middle way, because you have to know, you have to be able to hear each other. People have to be able to express their needs and their requests and their feelings. And it's a great project to gather together and learn to be able to do that and hear each other. But you can't have a middle way unless you can do that, because there's no one doctrine. You don't have a pope telling you what to do, you know, or a rabbi or whatever.
Would you say there are things that you found within Judaism that resonate really well with the middle way itself?
Yeah. Yes, actually, one of what I love the most about my studies was I really surprised myself, because when I was getting the master's degree, I had to write a thesis, and I ended up writing it on about a Talmud story that is a very popular story. That once I researched it more and more, discovered that the people who redacted the Talmud is the central literature of rabbinic Judaism. So in the year 200, there were a book, the Mishnah, was put together, and it's the scholarly discussions of a few scholars in the area in the Middle East. But then people wrote commentary on the Mishnah, and it was redacted, it was all put together in the year 500 or so. And there are these debates, and it includes a lot of laws, and it includes stories. And you can read between the lines and look at the stories and learn about these sages. Well, the story that I chose is about an oven. They're discussing whether an oven, should I tell you the
Go
story?
For it.
This might take a while. Anyway. Okay. It's okay. A story about whether an oven is pure. Oh, sure. It's really not about that, but it's a famous story, and Reb Eliezer says, this oven is pure. And the other sages say, no, it's not pure. And Reb Eliezer says, if this oven is pure, let the carob tree prove it. And the carob tree moves 100 cubits, and some say 400 cubits. And the other sages say, no, it's not pure. And then Eliezer says, if I'm right, let the water prove it. And the water in the aqueduct goes the other direction. And the other sages say, no, we're right. And then Eliezer says, if I'm right, let the schoolhouse walls come down. And they start to come down. And then Reb Yehoshua says, no, we're right. And then they stop from falling down in, you know, just for Yehoshua, they stop falling down. For Eliezer, they start falling down. And the schoolhouse walls are still crooked to this day. And then Reb Eliezer says, if I'm right, let it be from heaven. And a bat kol, which is a voice from heaven, the voice of God, says, why do you argue with Reb Eliezer? He's always right in these matters. And the other sages say, no, it is not in heaven. And then Reb Akiva is asked, so what did God say when he heard this? And Akiva says, God laughed and said, my sons have defeated me.
Definitely.
Sounds very humanist, right? I mean, like, wow, look at that story. This is in Talmud, you know. Yeah. When I first heard that story, I thought that was amazing. But what I discovered, this is the middle way part, is that that story is in the context of other writings. So before that story, there's whole lists of rules about verbal wronging and not shaming someone, including you should throw yourself into an oven before you shame someone. But let's go back to the Eliezer story. After that, he's excommunicated. He's banned from the community. And the consequences of that are horrendous. It causes the crops to burn. It causes the death of the leader of the sages because Eliezer was wronged. So that part of the story is almost never told. So the rabbis, by redacting that, they took that story of Eliezer and they put it in the middle of a discussion about verbal wronging. And they did that because they were criticizing their own themselves and what they do. They were choosing a middle way. They were saying, no, you can't. The majority might be wrong. It's not here nor there. They're not right. Eliezer, it's very nuanced. So they themselves were criticizing their own program in Talmud. And you'll find it again and again. I read one book where the scholars were saying whenever they talk about purity, the sages in Talmud, they are going to criticize themselves.
Interesting. I've heard something similar to this, that there's a very good law in that comes from the Talmud to do with a jury. I don't know if you're familiar with this, that I don't know if this still holds, but there's a law that is there to sort of guard against groupthink. So if someone, for example, is unanimously convicted by a jury, then the judge won't hold that to be good enough. You have to have one dissenter.
Oh, really? That's interesting.
Because that shows that a good debate has happened and that not everyone has succumbed to groupthink.
That's great. That's great. I love that. I'm going to look that up.
Well, in relation to this, this is another interesting thing for me, just looking at how Buddhism in the United States has evolved, especially more secular forms of it, and the Jewish community. There seems to be a very high proportion of Jews that are very interested in the middle way. Would you say that is partly because of the culture? What would you put that down to?
Well, in a way, I think there is this. I think in all branches of Judaism, there is this constant debate, and there really is no dogma. I mean, you do have the, you know, Karen Armstrong. You're probably familiar with Karen Armstrong. I think she's right when she says that fundamentalism is a modern phenomenon, that it's a reaction to modernism. And so the ultra-Orthodox reaction is actually a new, that's something new. But over the years of Judaism, there's always been debate, always uncertainty. There's no resolution. It's valued in Talmud study, it's valued, and it in modern times with people coming to America and integrating to into this culture, many Jews became lawyers and social, I mean, all sorts of professions that try to mend the world and also try to deal with justice. And it's within the tradition, it's strongly within the tradition, and there isn't a dogma. So there's always discussion. Even in a yeshiva, you will see people arguing all the time about what the meaning is of a text. And I think that a lot of Jews became Buddhists too. And in the Bay Area, many of the leaders of the Buddhist centers, including the Zen Buddhist centers, are Jews. And there are many Jewish leaders within the Buddhist community. And I mean, I still feel this loyalty to try to find some sort of Jewish practice.
Yeah.
But I totally understand why they've just gone over to that direction, because it's very appealing.
What do you think of the universality of the Middle Way? Like, for example, when, at the moment we're talking about a Jewish Middle Way, but could there also be a Muslim Middle Way, a Christian Middle Way? I mean, we were talking earlier on about Philip Kitcher. He argued very persuasively for an atheist Middle Way, or at least a soft atheist in his definition.
Yes.
Do you think the Middle Way, for example, is something that quite comfortably can be promoted beyond the Buddhist tradition?
Yes, I do. And there are people who are creating humanist communities in the U.S. I think that's happening in UK also. Alan de Botton is his name.
Right,
in the Boston area, there's a huge humanist community led by a rabbi who I studied with when I started in my rabbinic program. He was ordained through our program, and people gather together in humanist communities, and they celebrate all the holidays in a humanist way. And they have Sunday school to teach values to the kids. And it's all Middle Way. I mean, it's called humanist, but I think Middle Way is humanist. I think they seem synonymous to me from everything I've read. Perhaps, I mean, would you say that humanist and Middle Way is pretty...
I think we're talking about woolliness, but I think the term humanism... I find that term hard to pin down, really. I mean, it's cropped up in, you know, it's been around for centuries off and on, but it's had a real revival in the last sort of 50 years or so. But I'm not quite sure what it means. I don't know, what does it mean to you, humanist?
Well, it means being more human-centered than God-centered.
Okay.
So it's taking responsibility for the world and being willing to be open to not knowing beyond what we see.
Yeah, well, I think there's a lot of congruence there. I mean, to me, the Middle Way is, I suppose for me, principally, the Middle Way is a method of judgment that arguably you can make better decisions by avoiding fixed beliefs. I mean, that's the sort of negative side of it. I don't mean negative in a bad way, but you know, it's a strategy of avoidance. But then the sort of flip side to that is then when you do that, then the positive side of it is that it opens up to integration, and by not getting stuck in these fixed positions, then you've got room to breathe and maneuver and explore and be creative. And you know, and it's the other thing is it's messy in the middle, isn't it? It's not an easy place to be. It's a, yeah. In many ways the extremes are a lot more comfortable. But
no, I totally, you know, it is very fuzzy in the middle, and I understand. And I mean, I would like to find a middle way between celebrating Jewish culture and being in communities where everybody is completely comfortable, whether they're Jewish or not. So I have this, in a way, I have more of an orientation to wanna form groups that include everybody, yeah, and are not exclusively Jewish. And someone just asked me to work with him on this sort of Shabbat. And I balk when it feels exclusive. I don't. So I'm still exploring.
Okay, just my last question, Susan. If people wanted to find out more about what you do and your work, and I know that you have a blog, and also to find out more about the Institute for Secular Humanistic Judaism, how would they go about it?
Well, the Society for Humanistic Judaism website is shj.org, and that will tell you all about what humanistic Judaism is. And you can get to the Institute through that website as well. There'll be a link there. And for my blog is rabbijubu.com, rabbijubu.com.
Okay.
You can see my, in the name of that Jubu. I mean, I consider myself a Buddhist and a Jew.
That's great.
I will say one of the people who you interviewed, Stephen Batchelor, I love his books.
Uh-huh.
And the book he wrote, Buddhism Without Belief, I think is the equivalent of what Rabbi Sherwin Wein wrote for Judaism, Judaism Beyond God. It's the equivalent for Buddhism Beyond Belief, because it's a non-dogmatic, non-doctrinal Buddhism. And that's the kind of Buddhism that I can relate to.
Yeah, well Stephen's been very supportive of our society. One of the things that, just back to our conversation about religion, he often talks about the Chinese often say, for them, the religious sensibility is coming to terms with the great matter of birth and death. And he makes the point, coming to terms with or reconciling, not positing final answers. And I think, you know, when you think of the story of the middle way, you know, where the Buddha confronts birth, aging, sickness and death, and that's what we I think that's what I'm trying to do with my life anyway, to try and come to terms with my, you know, my existential condition and try and to reconcile that and come to terms with my world and the people with it, and not just the people but the planet and all its other inhabitants, and live with it in as much harmony as I possibly can within my psychological and physical limitations, of course.
Great quest.
Anyway, it's been wonderful talking to you today, Susan.
It's been a pleasure to talk with you as well.
You can find out more about Middle Way Philosophy at www.middlewaysociety.org.